And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And let's get into our commentary for this week. This one's written by Tim Weiner of the New York Times. It's entitled, A Farmer Learns About Mexico's Lack of the Rule of Law. From El Memeal, Mexico, Rudolfo Montiel, a farmer from this dirt-poor town up a lawless road in the southern mountains, saw the forest around him being destroyed. The cause, he said, was clandestine logging, financed by corrupt deals cut by local political bosses in league with the army. So 2 years ago, he and 100 friends and neighbors formed the Organization of Peasant Farmer Ecologists, protesting against the deforestation of their land and the destruction of their lives. A violent reaction followed of politically connected men who control the land and their allies in the army, which polices this part of the world, have apparently killed 4 of Mr. Montiel's friends, tortured others, and struck fear into the peasant farmers from miles around. No one has been prosecuted. No one here expects that. Quote, this is a place where people can kill without fear, said Albertano Peñaloza, 39, a farmer from nearby Banco Nuevo. Mr. Montiel and a friend, Teodoro Cabrera, are in prison framed by the army, according to the government's Human Rights Commission, but convicted nonetheless. Here, there's no justice, says Jesus Sanchez, 37, who runs the local cantina. The strongest one, the one who can kill someone else, is the one who makes the law, unquote. This kind of tale can be heard all over Mexico. Members of the police and the military can bend and break the law without much fear of punishment. Killing, torture, kidnappings, and false arrests by law enforcement authorities are prominent features of the legal landscape charted in recent reports by the United Nations, the United States State Department, the Organization of American States, and human rights groups. Mexican soldiers increasingly act as police officers. In the last 2 years, Mexico's leaders have ordered at least 5,000 soldiers to take the place of law enforcement agencies that the government concedes are corrupt or inefficient. In southern states like Guerrero, they are the only law enforcers and apparently all but immune from civil justice. Mexico's former governing party, ousted from the presidency by Mr. Fox after 7 decades, often used crooked police officers and corrupt courts to protect its loyalists and punish its enemies. Many Mexicans now perceive the justice system as little but a political tool. In Guerrero, Mr. Montiel said in a jailhouse interview, justice is whatever the politically powerful and their backers in the armed forces says it is. They're who people are afraid of, he said. They have a lot of power because they have made money from the wood. They can hire gunmen and pay off the government. El Memeal, a town of 400 people, stands far back in the roaring Sierra, 40 miles up a long, rough road from the Pacific Ocean, a long way from the modern world. It has no running water, no plumbing, no school, one store and one street, resembling a dry riverbed, trafficked mainly by pigs and chickens. The richest people in town own a few cattle and scratch out a living selling milk or cheese or meat or tacos. The poorest have almost nothing but the land around them. By law, they own the land. In reality, it's being stolen. In 1998, Mr. Montiel and his friends saw the land being systematically stripped of trees. With the trees went their way of life. The denuded hills were eroding. The arable land below was washing away. The springs that were their only source of drinking water were choking. What Mr. Montiel perceived, has been confirmed by satellite photographs. They show that 38% of the forest, some 215,000 acres around El Memeal, has disappeared in 8 years. People can see with their eyes that everything's being destroyed, said Jesus Cortez, 32, El Memeal's folk-singing bard, who has composed traditional songs about the wasting away of the land. Mr. Montiel's protests soon made him a target. First, he and his wife, Uvalde, were illegally searched by soldiers and robbed of their savings in the process, she said. Death threats followed. They fled with their 6 children to Mr. Cabrera's house in Pizolta. On May 2, 1999, soldiers burst into the house, arrested Mr. Montiel and Mr. Cabrera, and killed a friend of theirs, Salome Sanchez, another farmer. There's been no investigation, there's been no justice, there's been no consequences, there's been nothing. Nothing, said Mr. Sanchez's wife, Hermelinda, aged 41. The 2 arrested men were convicted in August of possessing drugs and guns, despite the fact that the National Human Rights Commission found in July that they had been framed. They were unarmed at the time of their arrest, the commission found. Soldiers planted guns and drugs on them, and they were tortured into confessing. The judge who is weighing their appeal is widely expected to rule. Edgar Cortez, director of the Miguel Agustin Pro Juarez Human Rights Center in Mexico City, the organization defending Mr. Montiel, said that throughout Guerrero, quote, soldiers are carrying out investigative work, taking on the role of the police and prosecutors, a role that does not belong to the army, unquote. The farmers group is in disarray. A friend of Mr. Montiel here, Senso Figueroa, 38, said, we live in fear of the law here. They can accuse us of anything. The federal judge who convicted Mr. Montiel, Maclavo Murillo Chavez, said it was an ordinary criminal case. I see a lot of weapons possession cases, he said in an interview. They're all the same. The police testified that the accused were in possession of a weapon. The prosecutors file an affidavit, and there is always a confession. Law enforcement workers in Mexico regularly obtain information through torture, and prosecutors use that evidence in court, which accept confessions extracted with the help of electric shocks, beating, or sexual abuse, human rights groups say. Amnesty International, which has named Mr. Montiel a prisoner of conscience, says the torture and arbitrary detention that he experienced are widespread in Mexico. The worst violators have been the federal and state judicial police, the rights groups say. The president, Ernesto Zedillo, has conceded that it is true. Instead of preventing, investigating, fighting crimes, the judicial police have become cruel and dangerous criminals, more so because of the impunity that follows their actions, he said 2 years ago. The incoming president, Mr. Fox's aides, have proposed doing away with the judicial police and creating a new national police force under a new federal prosecutor's office. A top advisor to Mr. Fox and a possible member of his cabinet, Jose Luis Reyes, a former federal prosecutor himself, said the aim was to create a, quote, true rule of law in which the police and military would be, quote, genuine protectors of society and not the source of fear for its citizens. The fear here has been growing since 1995 when 17 peasant advocates in Guerrero were killed by the authorities in a military-style ambush. A commission formed by the Supreme Court found that the governor of Guerrero had helped cover up the killing. Nothing became of the accusation. The fear became stronger after Mr. Montiel's arrest when military patrols began serving as the law in El Mameyal. Now a platoon of soldiers camps outside the town, its presence felt by every villager. Mrs. Montiel, who now lives in Iguala, where her husband is imprisoned, said even if he was free, they would be afraid to return home. Mr. Peñaloza, a farmer, said, we're losing our land, we're losing our lives, and we don't have anyone to complain to. We go to the local authorities, and they say, it's not their problem. And when we go to the governor, we have even less chance of an answer. We sure won't get it from the president. Maybe it's better for us to be quiet now. It's never better to be quiet, Mr. Peñaloza. That's why we have Earth First Radio, and that is the Earth First Radio commentary. Moving back into news, here's the good news and the bad news in the World Forestry Report. The authors of a landmark report released recently say the world should be thinking of forest quality, not just forest quantity. The report by the Washington-based World Resources Institute is called Pilot Analysis of Global Ecosystems, Forest Ecosystems. It is the first attempt to analyze the condition of forests worldwide based on their ability to provide a wide range of goods and services. Quote, we are not running out of trees, especially in the developed countries, unquote, said the lead author, Emily Matthews. We are, however, running through our old growth or primary forests. The report found that forest areas in developed countries continue to increase slightly, while clearance for agriculture, development, and logging in developing countries are reducing forests by at least 140,000 square kilometers every year. The report explains how roads, even in Central Africa, where transportation systems are less developed than in the West, have fragmented dense forests into smaller pieces. The report stresses that typically forests are assessed too narrowly, with only their size and capacity to produce commercially valuable fiber taken into account. On the positive side, production of all wood fiber products from logs to pulp is keeping up with demand. But the bad news is that nearly 80% of it comes from primary or secondary growth forests. This means irreplaceable ancient forests continue to be felled for fiber that could in principle be produced from plantations, said the report. Much of the wood production in developed countries takes place in secondary growth or managed forests, the report noted. The authors highlighted an encouraging trend toward more environmentally and socially responsible forestry practices. Nature conservation and amenity value are increasingly important in forestry management decisions, says the report. But the report warned that increasing production from plantations will not necessarily decrease harvest rates in natural forests. The authors recommend that governments encourage production from plantations and intensive forest management in selected areas while discouraging old-growth harvesting. Currently, many governments subsidize logging but not tree plantations, said the author Matthews. Here are the broad findings from the report, which can be found in full at www.wri.org/wri/wr2000. Again, that webpage is www.wri.org/wri/wr2000. Forests cover about one quarter of the world's land surface, excluding Greenland and Antarctica. Just over half are found in developing countries. Global forest cover has been reduced by at least 20% since pre-agricultural times, possibly by 50%. Forest area has increased slightly since 1980 in industrialized countries, but has declined by at least 10% in developing countries. Tropical deforestation rates are uncertain, but probably exceed 130,000 square kilometers every year. About 40% of forests are relatively undisturbed by human activity, though nearly half of these are likely to be developed soon. Arizona Restoration Timber Project has been appealed. The Center for Biological Diversity, the Sierra Club, and the Southwest Forest Alliance have appealed the Fort Valley Ecosystem Restoration Project on the Coconino National Forest. Using the pre-settlement model developed by the Northern Arizona University professor Wallace Covington, the Fort Valley Project would thin approximately 4,700 acres of ponderosa pine forest outside the city of Flagstaff in an attempt to recreate mid-19th century forest structure and to reduce fire danger. While the center supports forest restoration efforts, including the thinning of small trees where necessary, we believe the Fort Valley Project is much too heavy a cut, disturbs wildlife habitat too much, and fails to adequately account for the fact that forests change over time. The strict adherence to recreating conditions that occurred at one moment in time 140 years ago is a scientifically controversial approach to restoration. The center believes restoration should be based on existing forest structure and current ecological needs, such as those of declining species, with the past condition used as a touchstone rather than an anchor. Previous logging conducted under the pre-settlement model has removed up to 90% of existing trees, including many large trees, compacted the soils, and may have caused one of two known northern goshawks on Mount Trumbull within the newly designated Grand Canyon Parashant National Monument to abandon its territory. Over 100 years of logging, fire suppression, and domestic livestock grazing have transformed much of the Southwest majestic ponderosa pine forests into overly dense thickets prone to unnaturally intense and damaging crown fires. The Center for Biological Diversity, the Sierra Club, and the Forest Alliance are developing and testing restoration strategies designed to improve forest health and reduce crown fire danger through prescribed burning and conservative thinning, which retains all large trees, emphasizes the protection of wildlife and biodiversity, and focuses on forest processes such as restoration of natural fire regimes as well as forest structure. And a gold mine project on sacred Quechuan Indian land in California has been stopped. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt announced in nearly his last day in office the denial of the Glamis gold mine, which would have threatened sacred Native American sites in southeastern California. The denial is historic because it would be the first time the federal government has denied a major mining project on lands covered by the 1872 mining law. Previously, regulators had taken the outdated law to mean that they had to permit a mine under any circumstance. This historic denial uses several laws, including the California Desert Protection Act and legal opinions, to justify the mine denial and sets a precedent that mining is not the highest and best use of the land, a contention mistakenly held by regulators previously. In fact, the Department of Interior's record of decision states that one of the reasons the mine proposal was denied is that it, quote, fails to meet the overall statutory requirement in the Federal Land Policy and Management Act that the Bureau of Land Management must prevent unnecessary or undue degradation of the public land resources. The mine would have been located in an area of great cultural and religious importance to the nearby Quechan Indian Nation. It would have been in the Indian Pass area, which is in the eastern Imperial County, about 45 miles northeast of El Centro, California, and 20 miles northwest of Yuma, Arizona. Modern gold mines are enormous and often destructive operations. They require huge pits to be blasted and dug. The extracted rock is sprayed with cyanide or acid solutions to get at the minuscule amounts of gold, pieces so tiny they cannot be seen with the naked eye. The modern mining industry was recently pegged by the Environmental Protection Agency as the largest producer of toxic waste in the nation. The denial of the mine occurred at a press event at the Department of Interior in Washington, D.C. Speakers included Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt, who issued the denial, Ketchin President Mike Jackson Sr., and MPC President Stephen D'Esposito. Through this decision, law and land management have come full circle, said Courtney Ann Coyle, attorney for the Ketch Indian Nation. Today's action validates the traditional religious and cultural values placed on this land by the Ketchin people ever since time immemorial. It says that Indian sacred sites and access to them does matter, that unmitigated cumulative impacts to them must stop, and that environmental justice now has a seat at the federal land management table. As bad as the 1872 mining law is, there are laws that give the American public the ability to deny mines in places where they don't belong. The California Desert Protection Act, the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act all provide us not only with the ability, but also the imperative to protect our public lands and cultural resources, said MPC President Stephen Esposito. New environmental safeguards for mining on public lands go into effect on Inauguration Day. We call on President-elect Bush to protect our public lands. He should commit to responsible mining practices, commit to create an incentive for responsible mining companies, and commit to demonstrate his conservation ethic all in one simple act. He should commit to enforcing these new safeguards, D'Esposito added. The Mineral Policy Center, or MPC, is an environmental organization working to protect communities and the environment from the impacts of mining in the U.S. and worldwide. If you'd like further information, you can contact the Mineral Policy Center. Their number, 202-887-1872. That's 202-887-1872. And let's move into some animal news here. Critical habitat has been proposed for 32 Hawaiian plants. The fourth in a series of seven critical habitat proposals covering 255 Hawaiian plant species was released by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. If made final, this proposed rule would establish 28 critical habitat units on the island of Molokai, including 15,227 acres of private, state, and federal lands. With this proposal, we have met our court-ordered deadline to propose critical habitat designations or non-designations for 100 Hawaiian plant species, said Ann Badgley, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Pacific Regional Director. Our ultimate goal is to recover these plants and eventually remove them from the list of threatened and endangered species. The 28 critical habitat units are concentrated on the eastern and northwestern portions of the island of Molokai. Most of the acreage is on the state and private lands. The proposed rule for Molokai plants addresses 40 species and proposes critical habitat designations for 32 of them. Critical habitat was not proposed for seven species because they only exist on lands protected by the Nature Conservancy in its Mumumi, Pelekunu, and Kamakau preserves. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is also not proposing critical habitat for one species of the native Loulou palm in order to avoid increasing threat to the species from vandalism or collection. That's strange. We're not going to protect it because it's rare and it could be vandalized. That's very weird. Anyway, back to the news story. Several of the listed plants have 10 or fewer individual plants remaining in the wild, including five species that only exist on Molokai. If you'd like to comment on this proposed critical habitat, you can do so for the next 60 days. Email can be sent to fw1pie_molokai, that's M-O-L-O-K-A-I, underscore crithab, C-R-I-T-H-A-B. I'll go over that once again. I know these are long, folks, but try and keep up as you write. fw1pie_molokai, M-O-L-O-K-A-I, underscore crithab, crithab, at fws.gov. And a Wisconsin man has been convicted for his role in shooting a bald eagle. A Crandon, Wisconsin man has been convicted for shooting a bald eagle in the Forest County on March 17th of the year 2000, Richard Allen Marvin was charged in federal court in Milwaukee with possession of a bald eagle. Marvin was fined $1,000 plus $500 restitution and a $25 in special assessments. He was placed on federal probation for 1 year, during which he is barred from any type of hunting during that time and must do 50 hours of community service. Marvin drove the truck that the shooter, Michael Pagel, was riding in. The men saw an immature bald eagle off Old 8 Road near the Little Rice Flowage. Pagel shot the bird with a .22-caliber rifle from the truck. Pagel pleaded guilty to his part in the crime and will be sentenced shortly. From Texas, some cave species have been listed as endangered. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has listed as endangered 9 species of invertebrates known only from caves in the northern part of Bexar County, Texas. Though not as majestic as the bald eagle or as appealing as the black-footed ferret, these species are unique and fascinating creatures that also serve as good indicators of the overall health of the ecological systems on which humans ultimately depend. That's according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Southwest Regional Director Nancy Kaufman. When species like these 9 invertebrates begin to disappear from the planet, it is a sign that the natural world around us is under a great deal of stress. The invertebrates are animals without internal skeletons or backbones, such as butterflies, beetles, or spiders. The 9 species listed as endangered include 3 beetles, 5 spiders, 1 harvestman, a relative of common household daddy longlegs. All right, let's see. I think I had a list of them. Hold on here. Where are they? Where's that list? I knew I had it here somewhere. Here they are. Where's that list? The Raudine exilis, which has no common name. The Raudine infernalis, also no common name. Batrachotis venyivi, which is the Helotes mold beetle. Texella cocondolferi, the robber baron cave harvestman. The Cincarina baronia, the robber baron cave spider. Cincarina malda, the Malda's cave spider. Cincarina vinii, there's no common name for that one. Cincarina vespera, the vesper cave spider. And Neoleptonita microps, the Government Canyon cave spider. All 9 inhabit karst features, which are limestone formations containing caves, sinks, and fissures near San Antonio, Texas. Threats to the species include destruction and or deterioration of habitat by construction, filling of caves, loss of permeable cover, contamination from septic effluent, sewer leaks, runoff, and pesticides. All those wonderful things. Let's see, we have time for a short one here. Here's one. Indian police seize 800 turtles, gang arrested. Police in the northern Indian city of Lucknow have seized more than 800 turtles from a gang suspected of trying to smuggle them to Southeast Asia. Police said the endangered turtles were likely to have been used to make soups. 4 persons were arrested along with 8 gunny bags stuffed with live turtles while they were on their way to Calcutta, from where they were to be sneaked out via Bangladesh to Southeast Asian nations, police said on. They said the 4-member gang arrested were expected to be charged under a wildlife law banning trade in endangered species. Interrogation of the arrested persons revealed that the turtles are in great demand in Southeast Asian countries where they're used for making a special kind of soup, according to Bibi Bakish, police chief of Lucknow, capital of the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh, and we thank Reuters for that little short one. Anyway, that is all the time we have for news. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzeif@cruzio.com. That's cruzeif@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That is Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Be sure to send any and all announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you like more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, you can subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their current address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to www.microradio.net/FRSC and listen in. You can also find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. and that's an MP3 file. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local radio station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening. And now we're going to listen to a little Casey Neal. This one's called The Power Is Turning.
Serpent's eye. The power is turning. The power is turning. Rogue spirits are waiting, anticipating. Voices long forgotten again will awaken. The fire in the eye of the eagle, deep and regal. No voice rivals the song of the past. At last, at last, at last, the power is turning. The wild sea is burning. Watch as it comes alive. A world is emerging. See it in the gleam of the serpent's eye. The power is turning. The power is turning. This is not the end of the world, it is only the beginning. An awakening, a reckoning, the nameless is returning. Rising from the western ocean, shining off the sea. Carried by a magic wind, alive again, alive again. The power is turning, the wild sea is burning. Watch as it comes alive. A world is emerging. See it in the gleam of the serpent's eye. The power is turning. The power is turning. The power is turning. The power is turning.